This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program, in a special edition, we have a panel of experts. As President Joe Biden finally takes office, we will be looking back at the legacy of Trump, but we'll be looking forward at what our hopes are for the 46th President of the United States. Joining me is Tom Tugendhat, Chair of the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. We have MK Michal Kotler-Wunsch, who also chairs a couple of committees. We have Richard Pater, who's the CEO of BICOM, and William Daroff, the CEO of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Welcome to you all, and thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's get straight into this. William, if we start with you. A bit of a moment of American history. It's very strange, actually, how we don't really fully appreciate when inaugurations happen that they are a moment of history in the making. And yesterday, for some reason, that seemed to feel more the case than ever before.
Well, absolutely. The events of January 6th with the rioting, the insurrection on Capitol Hill brings to a fore how tender and important democracy is, and the sort of stability of our institutions. And I believe that on January 20th, with the inauguration of President Biden, we affirmed the fact that democracy is tender and precious and something that we can continue with our 200 plus year history in this path. So it was a real affirmation of those institutions and of what we have become as a republic.
And I wonder what the feeling is just around the world now, because I don't know whether or not this is just my imagination, but I feel as if there's a very different vibe instantly for the fact that Donald Trump has now left the White House and that Joe Biden has taken office. Out of interest, Michal, what would you say the mood is like in Israel? Because arguably, Donald Trump was a very pro-Israel president. And we don't necessarily know, I mean, we can judge it from his history as vice president, but we don't necessarily know what a Biden presidency is going to mean for Israel yet. But the feeling around the Knesset, is it positive so far, would you say?
First of all, the feeling around the Knesset is we are at a time of elections, and you can imagine what that looks like. That has all kinds of implications. I just want to say, in addition to the historic magnitude that William referred to, is of course the historic nature of VP Harris having been for the first time sworn in as a woman. And I think women around the world actually heard the glass ceiling shatter last night, and the historic time of which we are living in with all of its challenges. COVID-19 has challenged the entire world. And so we stand together as we face those challenges. With regards to the outgoing presidency and the incoming administration, I have to say that with everything to do with regards to Israel, we have been a very, very important part of the U.S.'s policies on that have enabled the Abraham Accords, that have partnered with processes that we see in the Middle East with global implications. And I want to believe, and I actually do believe, regarding the incoming administration, that we will continue these historic processes, that there won't be daylight between the administrations in terms of what we have achieved historically, because the paradigmal shift from what we know of as the three no's of Khartoum, no to recognition of Israel, no to negotiation, and no to peace, the paradigmal shift to the three yeses, yes to recognition, yes to negotiation, and yes to peace, which have enabled this historic pivot from rejectionism to normalization, those are what is very deeply felt in Israel, and the continuation of them with everything, of course, that they impact, including what we will have to deal with, the JCPOA return or review, and everything with regards to Iran's threats in the region and beyond. Those are, I think, inherent to the excitement that was deeply felt in Israel yesterday as well.
Well, now you've brought up the subject of Iran. I think that we should sort of go down that route. It's without a shadow of a doubt the elephant in the room, that an awful lot of people have said that since Joe Biden did make it very clear that he would re-enter an agreement, an understanding based on Iran and nuclear that, of course, was initially implemented by President Obama. And then Donald Trump overturned it and walked away from it. And now Joe Biden said he's going to walk back into it. It feels a little bit like this could be a bit of a seesaw moment, you know. And I don't know whether or not I'm the only one who feels this almost sense of trepidation and nerves, because I have no doubt in my mind's eye, from what I've seen and from what I've heard, that Joe Biden appears to be a friend of Israel in one way or another. But what I'm not sure about is whether or not he could appreciate, and I hope he does, appreciate the implication of what it would mean to even just have on an official piece of paper an agreement with Iran based on nuclear power. And Richard, am I the only one who sort of has this sense of nerves around this, or do you think that there is a sort of a wider sense of dis-ease around such an agreement?
Well, listen, there's no doubt that there is shared concern across the world, even because we're all playing the same guessing game of exactly what will be the formulation of President Biden's policy. You mentioned it in your opening. I think it's very clear that we should understand that President Biden is his own man, and we shouldn't judge him just by the legacy that he was part of the Obama administration. I think there are signs of cautious optimism if you look at his candidate for Secretary of State, Blinken, and kind of the reassuring messages that he was talking about during his confirmation hearing this week that spoke about that there's going to be a dialogue with the regional partners, which implies what Michal said, the importance of the Abraham Accords that have been built upon and the shared concerns that Israel and the Gulf allies kind of share together. And so it's most appropriate that these concerns with regard to Iran are talked about in closed rooms with the leaders of Israel and the Gulf states alongside the US administration.
And Tom, from your perspective, what would you sort of say that you weigh up in terms of sort of what we're potentially facing now as far as the future of a Biden administration is concerned versus Iran nuclear deal just to start with?
Well, first of all, I think the Iran nuclear deal concerns Britain very greatly. I think it's fundamental to the security of the British people, both at home and abroad. These are not foreign places about which we know little, as somebody once said about Czechoslovakia. These are fundamental to the security of Britain and her allies, including Israel, but actually many others as well. So these are important moments, not just for the Biden administration, but for the United Kingdom, for the E3 with France and Germany, for the whole of Europe and for the whole of the Middle East. So I hope very much that the Biden administration will look hard at the current Iranian government and the Iranian regime and realize this is not the regime they did a deal with in 2014 or 2015. This is already a different regime. The mass increase in uranium that has been seen over recent months is a big change. The development of missile technology that's now being tested by Houthis aiming at the desalination plants of the western seaboard of Saudi Arabia is a big change. And the attempt to undermine many other Sunni areas, including in places like Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, is a big change. So this is not Obama Mark II, if you like. This is Biden Mark I, and it's a different time.
Well, if it is a different time, then are you, I don't know whether or not concerned is the right word, but to what extent do you think that, say, UK policy on Israel could potentially be impacted by the Biden administration? I know that I'm asking for a lot of forecasting here, and I realize this is very unfair of me on all of you, but I guess that sort of you are all the best place to answer these questions, which a lot of people will have. And I know that sort of Israel and the UK have normally had very close ties together, but it's also been heavily influenced based on America's stance. So should we be cautiously optimistic that sort of the great relations the UK and Israel has had moving in the past will move forward in the same way? Or do we think that it could change as a result of a Biden administration?
The direction of travel for British-Israeli relations is very strong. It's extremely positive. I don't see any noticeable obstacles. I mean, there's always tensions between nations because that's just the nature of international diplomacy. But the reality is we have some of the closest relations together than any other country. We share more intelligence, we share more technology than almost any other country in the world. And so I see the proximity of our nations only to grow. And it's worth noting that, you know, this has gone up and down over the years. I mean, that's just simply true. although I was very, very pleased to hear Michal speaking about glass ceilings in the United States, it's worth pointing out that Golda Meir may have done that a few years earlier in Israel, and Margaret Thatcher one or two years earlier in the United Kingdom. So this isn't just glass ceilings in the United States. It's a very positive direction of travel from around the world.
I did want to say, vis-a-vis Iran and the world having changed in these last several years, yes, the Abraham Accords as well. So change for the positive, but also very, very serious challenges with what we see as the disinformation challenge, right? Anti-Semitism is but one piece of it. And actually, you know, I launched an international bipartisan task force to combat online anti-Semitism as it affects offline behaviors in that vein exactly. Because in this sense, we are bound together. If COVID-19 has shown anything, it is that what unites us is far greater than what divides us. And with regards to Iran, it is not just the nuclear program, as Tom was insinuating. There are the ballistic missiles. There is the international law lens. There is a human rights perspective. There is a journalist that was hung in Iran but 2 weeks ago. And there are the people of Iran that we have to differentiate from the Iranian regime. And the Iranian regime, which is not held to account, and the Iranian regime, which international law or the implementation of international law and human rights standards enables to get scot-free and actually empowers that culture of impunity of terror regimes like the Iranian regime, is one that is a global challenge. It is definitely not singularly Israel's or the UK's or the United States. And in that sense, there is tremendous opportunity alongside the great challenges that we face and address the double standards that have thus far enabled the culture of impunity, not only in Iran, but worldwide. And I believe that that is the call of our time.
Just to go back to you, William, one we were saying just now about the concerns surrounding other countries, especially in the Middle East or what have you. One of the first things that President Biden did was he used an executive order to overturn Donald Trump's ban on predominantly Muslim-based countries entering America, which Donald Trump has always said was based on a threat to national security. You know, he was, even though he was accused by many of being out and out racist for that particular move, he always said it was because it was in the interest of national security. Does that mean now that Biden has done that, that there is a greater threat to American security? Are Americans worried by the potential threat of terrorism now as a result of him having undone that particular trait of Donald Trump's?
I've not heard that concern expressed, Phil. The Muslim ban, I think pretty much 4 years later, is seen as being somewhat arbitrary, picking countries that weren't particularly known as being hotbeds of terror. So I think the move away from that is something that it has not created that much criticism. I think that other moves that we saw on the first day of the Biden administration point to a renewed multilateralism, engaging with international organizations, engaging with our traditional allies, our NATO allies, our EU allies, and others around the world, relationships that have had some trouble over the last 4 years. And that's something that I believe is pretty well endorsed and respected by policy circles here in Washington.
Can I just back that up? I mean, I it's worth remembering that when the Muslim ban came in, one of the first people to speak out against it was Jonathan Goldblatt of the Anti-Defamation League. This is not something that many people have seen as a security policy, but as a problematic issue for the United States to resolve. And I'm very glad that the Biden administration has done that.
And dare I butt in again and say that the Abraham Accords, as they potentially will include additional countries, of course, of citizens from Muslim origin, makes it almost a moot point. And so that really it is part of the historical process that we're talking about, and only appropriate that that ban, too, should be lifted in the United States. It doesn't even exist in Israel.
On the note of the Abraham Accords, actually, I mean, there have been sort of some suggestions. It was reported that potentially that Donald Trump had been close to maybe sort of getting maybe a couple more deals as far as those are concerned. Do we think now that sort of maybe the momentum behind them might run the risk of slowing down, that just based on that we obviously don't have the same administration as the driving force behind them?
I will briefly say that one of the very positive aspects coming out of the Biden administration's foreign policy circles has been an embrace of the Abrahamic Accords. And while we can see and have seen just in the last 24 hours how policies are being reversed, this is the one area really in foreign policy where you see the Biden team endorsing where the Trump team had been. And so I am optimistic about the administration looking for more opportunities to leverage these relationships with Arab and Muslim states.
Of course, what we see happening, and we keep going into this moment of history that we are in the midst of and are privileged to be living in. And if we identify the opportunities that this moment offers us, it really, I referred to it a little bit before, but it's about the power of moderation and the responsibility of moderates. So what we see is actually moderate Muslim countries taking back Islam from radicalization, from radicalism and extremism. And there is tremendous potential there that I truly believe and hope. And as William indicated, the administration has already noted that it intends to pick up exactly where we've left off, just a continuum, to enable additional nations, countries, peoples that accept that paradigm shift that I referred to before, that begins with recognition, mutual recognition of the other's right to exist. In Israel's case, that is Israel as Jewish and Democratic's right to exist. Recognition, which then leads to negotiation, which enables long-lasting, sustainable peace and prosperity. And so I tend to believe that there will be many more countries that join and peoples that join. And I do hope that it serves as an inspiration for the Palestinians as well, and to have the leadership that will identify this opportunity and the paradigm shift that is inherent to this shift or the pivot away from rejectionism to normalization.
Richard, how do you feel about all of this? Because obviously this is very closely sort of linked to what you do with the work at BICOM. So in this shift that we speak about, and also noting more and more recognition and just sort of right to exist, it seems like such a simple premise, but isn't it extraordinary how right to exist seems to trouble an awful lot of folk? And Richard, I suspect that you sort of get quite caught up in this from time to time.
Well, I think first of all, it's really important. It's been said already, but worth emphasizing the importance of the symbolism of the Abraham Accords, of taking the father of monotheism and showing that commonality and shared roots of Judaism, Islam and Christianity, of building those bridges, is incredibly powerful and important. And I would also say that before we kind of speculate and talk about other countries that could join the fold, we're only just starting to scratch the surface on what we're building. It's only 6 months and there's already been a great amount of achieved already. There's been kind of the government-to-government contact has been significant in over 170 memorandum of understanding signed. And now we're starting to see that already seep down to people-to-people and institutions contact as well. I heard a former diplomat say to me the other day that actually normalization is actually better than peace. If peace is just the absence of war, normalization means that there can be real economic contact, social contact. And I said the societies to societies can get to know each other. And we very much hope, obviously, we saw already kind of around the Christmas Hanukkah period of Israelis flocking to Dubai already. But we hope in a post-coronavirus world that can only be amplified and explored, and there can be far more meaningful contact. And obviously in Israel, we look forward to welcoming Emiratis and the Gulfists to visit Israel as well.
So something I'd like to sort of just change the direction of conversation just a little bit, because there's so much to talk about and I'm very aware of the time. But William, to go back to you, obviously you and other Americans are waking up to the dawn of a new era. You have your new president, but you also have your new vice president, which of course Michal alluded to earlier on, has finally broken a glass ceiling that really, for a Western country, should have been broken a long, long time ago. But let's not dwell on that too much. On Kamala Harris's, point of view, because I suspect there are some people around the world who don't necessarily know much about her and her politics, but from your perspective, do you think that she stands to be a good ally to the Jewish community of America?
I do. She has a very solid record of support for a strong U.S.-Israel relationship. Her first engagement interaction with the state of Israel was when she was the local district attorney in San Francisco and had relations there with the local Jewish Community Relations Council and went to Israel with them, in fact. So she has solid relationships starting with the beginning of her political career and moving through her career in state office in California and then in the Senate. So we believe that she firmly supports a strong U.S.-Israel relationship, that she has excellent connections throughout the community. And in fact, those connections extend within her home, where obviously she's married to Doug Emhoff, who is Jewish and is raising two Jewish children, and is so very much engaged with the family nickname of Mamala, with its Yiddish roots. So she's very much engaged with our community. We're pretty upbeat about the impact that she'll have and the influence that she'll have in the administration.
And Michal, from your stance, of course, that this, I can only assume, and it, please forgive me, because it's very hard to have these conversations as a white British male without sounding like some sort of ism, whether it's sexism, xenophobia, whatever. I'm just going to say how I see it. Is it a case that now that America has finally caught up with the rest of sort of the Western civilization and some more democratic countries, such as Israel, for example, that has always prided itself on leaders, whether they be male or female? I mean, obviously, Godomir got to mention earlier on. I can only assume that sort of this must be an exciting moment.
So it's beyond the fact that she's a woman, which makes her extremely capable in and of itself. It's, of course, the other glass ceiling that I was referring to when I spoke about it earlier is actually the multiplicity of identities coexisting harmoniously within her as a leader. And so when you think of her own personal history of the trials and tribulations that have enabled her to become vice president of the United States of America, it's not just that she's a woman. And the multiplicity of identities is actually what lends itself to the process that I believe that we spoke about a little bit earlier, that the world has to, you know, sort of that looks to the ability or the role that the United States can play, to the influence that the United States can have. And I want to also piggyback off of what Richard said a little bit before, because I think this has to do with it a little bit, at least, with regards to the recognition that, you know, sort of first step of the paradigm shift and what that looks like and the people to people, the warmth that can actually be felt in the engagements that we have. I hosted the first ever Bahraini UAE. There was actually an Egyptian representative too in Knesset on Hanukkah, and a miracle it felt like. I can tell you that it was one of my highlights in my seven short months in Knesset, a real highlight where I felt that we were history in the making and all of us shared that sense. But what's very important to understand, and I think that this is where Kamala Harris's multiple identities also resonate deeply, is that tolerance and coexistence actually comes through education. And I say this as a legislator and as a lawyer. It is very important to note, and it's really, really unique, that the UAE began and changed its curriculum for its children a few years in the making, teaching tolerance, teaching coexistence, that the Abraham Accords already appear in what school children are taught today. And that is something that I think we should both be inspired by and learn from. And I would be remiss if I didn't note in this context that both Bahrain and Morocco have adopted in one form or another the IHRA working definition for anti-Semitism. Now, if that is not recognition, and as we all know, the IHRA working definition for anti-Semitism includes what is known as the three Ds, the demonization, delegitimization, and double standards against the state of Israel. That is fundamental in the difference that we see. And I think that it is her actual multiple identities that I hope very much to be able to engage with and by, based on this tremendous bipartisan relationship that we already have and the shared values that we have and the additional components of the understanding of multiple identities, bringing this to the fore and being able to have these conversations in a way that really cements realizes the tremendous potential of that paradigm shift and not just leaves it at its potential.
And, you know, one thing as well that I can't help but think of, and Richard and William, I'd like to sort of get both of your thoughts on this in particular, is if we think back to very, very recent history, a couple of weeks ago, Capitol Hill riots, where we saw people openly wearing T-shirts with swastikas on and all sorts of other horrible anti-Semitic revolting stuff on them. And not to mention, if you go back slightly further to the Charlottesville debacle that happened under President Trump, where there seemed to be almost this rise, this almost oxygen being given to far rightism. And it seems now that sort of just in a short space of time, we can almost look back at that. I'm not saying it will never happen again, but it feels as though there's less chance of anything like that happening under Biden. And I wonder whether or not sort of either of you think the same way, or whether or not is that just sort of a little bit Pollyanna-ish and a bit hopeful, or could there actually be some hope and truth to that?
I think it's a good question. I think that generally speaking, we're upbeat about the path ahead. I think that while certainly there are challenges, that we believe that the folks in the administration are well suited to take them on.
I think we should never be kind of resting on our laurels that anti-Semitism and racism, either from the far left or from the far right, is gone and past just because of this new administration. It's incumbent on all of us to be ever vigilant and to be calling it out wherever we see it. We very much hope that the tone that this new administration strikes makes it clear that any sort of racism and anti-Semitism is unacceptable and receives kind of that wall-to-wall bipartisan support and backs that up as well.
And I think it's worth noting that when President Biden talked about why he decided to run for president, it's the Charlottesville riots where the demonstrators were demonstrating against Jews. The Jews will not replace us, among other chants, and President Trump's lukewarm response at best to that. So I do believe that the administration is focused on the insidiousness of the canards of anti-Semitism. The fact that the new anti-Semitism envoy for the incoming administration has been upgraded to ambassadorial status means that that individual will have higher ability to influence policy and to influence actions across the world. So there is very much a focus on this. I think the January 6th events absolutely ensure that we recognize that the hate that focuses on Jews comes from many different quarters, from the right, from the left, from radical Islam, and we can't let down our guard in any direction.
And not to mention, of course, that we absolutely should not forget the attacks that we've witnessed on synagogues as well, that of course has taken place.
I think it's very important that we contextualize what we see with regards to both January 6th, yesterday's inauguration, and the anti-Semitism, the virulent anti-Semitism that we see on digital platforms. And of course, actually, the heinous crime that you're referring to in the Tree of Life synagogue, which was the single worst anti-Semitic act ever committed in the United States, seeing 11 worshipers murdered that morning. Those are all, and it's very important that we note, yes, anti-Semitic acts, but it is not just about Jews, and it is certainly not just about our commitment to combat anti-Semitism online or its offline manifestations and implications. I truly believe that we are headed for, and in our generation, must confront what I called the disinformation challenge, because of digital space and because of these new technologies that we did not and do not yet have the capacity. And if you think of the print press, and when we began to use the print press as humanity, then we need to renegotiate what that looks like. What are the regulations that regulate this new vehicle for communication between us? What are the legislations of each of our countries going to look like? What is the global component? Because in this case, of course, it is a global challenge. And I can tell you that I held 3 hearings in the Knesset committee with regards to combating online anti-Semitism, and had Twitter and Facebook and Google and appear at these hearings, and TikTok, of course, appear at these hearings. And the challenges are not only in terms of the business model and holding to account and demanding transparent policy that is implemented equally and consistently. The challenge is far beyond that. The challenge is ours, as humanity, to learn to utilize these new technologies in ways that we can actually ensure the viability of democracy. Because what we see is the potential threat of disinformation on the very foundations of all of our democracies. And it is not just about anti-Semitism. So it may begin with anti-Semitism, but inevitably, as we know from history, it never ends there.
Well, it certainly doesn't. And on that subject of disinformation, there seems to be a lot of concern and confusion as to whether or not President Biden will use his sort of time in office to undo further some of the work of President Trump. I think it's worth mentioning that not everything President Trump achieved was all bad, you know, and I hope that people do recognize that in between all of the nonsense. One thing in particular that absolutely struck a chord with the global Jewish community was finally the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital and moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And now, of course, there is concern that he may at some stage look to move it back again. Do any of you share that concern? Should we be worried about it? Or do we think that that's it now, he'll move on from it?
I mean, my assessment in looking at it is that we shouldn't be too worried about it. I think that he's gone on record, and senior members of the administration have already stated that two policies beyond the Abraham Accords that they will maintain is one, to keep the embassy in Jerusalem, and also to maintain the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So I think I would be very concerned if that was to change, but I don't see that coming. I think we can be quite confident. And by the way, from an Israeli perspective, you know, it's quite clear to all of us here that we understand Jerusalem was always Israel's capital. We didn't need the kind of an international government, any government, however friendly, to endorse that approach. It seems kind of quite obvious, perhaps, but nevertheless, an element of Zionism has always been that recognition of the world and the world powers to have that. And certainly we will encourage the UK government to follow suit, although I don't think that's inevitable in the short term.
Richard, how do you think, out of interest, that Bibi and Biden will get on? Because obviously Donald Trump sort of came across as a great friend of Bibi Netanyahu and certainly seemed to be pleased to either speak to him or communicate with him. Do we think that Joe Biden can maintain that same relationship, or their politics are just too different, do we think?
First of all, I would just kind of characterize just how extraordinary and unusual the Trump relationship was with the Prime Minister's office. If you look at the most senior advisors, if you take the Middle East coordinators, both Jason Greenblatt and then Avi Berkovitz, the US ambassador, all his advisors. If you look at the Israeli side, the National Security Advisor, the Israeli ambassador to Washington, if you have those people around the table, the only person not wearing a kippah is the Prime Minister of Israel. So that's kind of, that was how we were in the Trump era. This is kind of a back to normalcy, but I think it is important in the world of kind of personality politics. Both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Biden do go back a long way. Both have said they have a great relationship, but I also think that this return to normalcy also brings the institutions and the offices of power on both sides back into the form. And so you will find that kind of the strength of the relationship is not based on the individuals; it's about a connection of institutions and about long stood values and principles that bring the two sides together.
And Mikhail, of course, not forgetting that with the impending elections again for Israel, he may not actually have to worry about it for too long anyway, whether or not he gets on with Bibi or not.
Well, you know, I think that what Richard just said actually resonates very, very strongly. I think it's very important to depersonalize this relationship. I think it is a longstanding, historic, values-based, bipartisan relationship that transcends time and people. And we have to continue to focus on that. And it's actually very important to move away from the personalization of this relationship. And I would even say the politicization of that relationship, because in fact, no matter who was sitting around the table, and yes, the fact that Jerusalem has been at the heart and the soul of the Jewish people for millennia, not just since the 72-year-old foundation of the State of Israel with the return of an indigenous peoples to its ancestral homeland, but for millennia, it is very important. And it is an endorsement, which, you know, I would say a ringing endorsement, which Israel is very grateful for. But at the end of the day, as Richard said, Jerusalem has always and will always be the capital of the Jewish people. And in its rendition of this sovereign state of Israel, the importance of it is not that it isn't, you know, of tremendous magnitude, but it transcends the people that made that or that enabled that moment. So that, and if it doesn't actually, then we fear, or I would fear at least, a turn back of the clock. It really, in order to be able to have the continuum that we've been discussing, to identify that history has shifted dramatically in the last, I would say, 4 years, it's certainly in the last year, and to identify the opportunities that come with those shifts, it would be a mistake to identify them with specific personalities or people, because in order for them to have their transcendent effect, transcendent impact, we have to leave them there as historical processes that really transcend the people and are enabled by a very deep relationship between the United States and Israel based on shared values and commitments and interests.
And the relationship between our two countries and our two peoples are not based on Republican values or Democratic values, but are based on American values and on the values that we hold together as peoples, on the interests that we hold together. And it's something that has been the case going from Democratic administration, starting with Harry Truman in 1948, to the present day. And so that is a solid relationship that I agree with Mahal. We need to focus on the continuation and the bonds that bring us together throughout time and throughout administrations, both here in the United States and in Israel.
Just to finish on, because we are pretty much out of time, but I want to bring it back to America, and in particular, bring it back to American Jews. William, I just wonder, why do you think it is, and this might sound like a bit of an odd question, based on the fact that obviously President Biden is already in office, he's been voted for, and that's it. Where do you think that the historic ties between the Jewish community of America and the Democrats comes from? Because typically speaking, Jews in America do vote Democrat, so I am guessing the majority of the Jewish community in America must be quite happy now and quite relieved that President Biden is in office. But in contrast to that, typically speaking here in the UK, we see that British Jews overwhelmingly, and I'm not saying for a second that there aren't those who don't have their share of left-leaning politics, but overwhelmingly they do seem to support more conservative values. So I just wonder, sort of from purely an educational point of view, why you believe that the alignment in America with the Jewish community is much more towards the Democrat, which is obviously more liberal.
So I'd start by saying that Jews are disproportionately engaged in the political process here on both sides of the aisle, among Republicans and Democrats. Richard noted the peace team that the Trump administration had. There are times when the West Wing has been called the West Bank because of the number of Jewish advisors who are there and engaged. And that's obviously both sides of the aisle, particularly when you look on the campaign finance ends of things, among the largest participators and donors and those engaged with Republicans and Democrats are leaders of the Jewish community. As far as sort of the masses, you know, it's a good political science question. I think it actually just goes back to centuries of Jewish history where the forces of progress tended to be the ones that liberated us, Napoleon et al., and the forces of conservatism, you know, looking at the Tsar or whomever, were the forces that tended to enslave us. And that sort of focus on progress and focus on connecting with those liberal forces is something that has continued to this day. But we see a continuation, though, of support on both sides of the aisle. But I do believe that sort of in our genetic past is this predisposition towards the forces of progressivism.
Panelists, if I may say, it has been an absolute privilege speaking to you today. Thank you very much indeed. I dare suggest that there will be plenty more to talk about in the years to come under President Biden. But unfortunately, we are out of time for now. But thank you very much for listening to the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and, of course, worldwide. To find out more, you can always go to gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to our guests, to Tom Tugendhat, to Michael Kotler-Wunsch, of course, member of the Knesset, Richard Patter, CEO of BICOM, and William Daroff, CEO of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Thank you all very much indeed. Do not forget that if you would like more information on any of the stories, the features, the subjects that we've covered here, I'm perfectly sure that on all information pertaining to the coverage of the American inauguration of Joe Biden, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you would like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you as well. Email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new ones become available. That's it from me, Phil Dave. Do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.